My name is Jeff Medford, and I'm with the Office 365 team out of Microsoft Corporate, and I'm a technical product manager, and I focus on Office 365 deployment, the programs, the tools, the messaging, the guidance that encompasses Office 365 deployment from a worldwide perspective. And with me is Alistair Spears, and I'll let him introduce himself also.
Thanks, Jeff. My name is Alistair Spears. I'm an operations PM in the Office 365 team too. I focus on deployment, technical readiness, technical training, and making sure you guys have everything you need to deploy into Office 365 as fast as possible, based out of Seattle as well.
And we also have Marissa Salazar, who's going to talk quickly about user adoption as part of this Office 365 deployment session, and she'll come up at the end. So we wanted to start off, and I did actually want to ask a couple questions. How many Office 365 customers do we have here today? Okay. Good.
Just here to check up on us.
Yeah, just here to check up. And as far as those who just raised your hand, how many feel you are fully deployed on Office 365? Okay, perfect. So hopefully we can help with that and help everyone who is not yet an Office 365 customer see how we can move through some of these deployment scenarios. And everyone who is an Office 365 customer looking at their current deployment or how they are going to move through this process, hopefully this will help you as far as some of the decision points to make, the technologies you can use, and some of the next steps you can take directly out of this room. So for those who are not already Office 365 customers, I did want to just break down and go through a little bit of the business value side. And you see here the four core marketing pillars from a new Office perspective. And you see devices, cloud, social, and control. And when we think about these pieces of building software and services, these are our core tenets. And it really comes down to being a full, fluid, immersive experience across devices. And you'll see some of that in our session tomorrow when we talk about Click to Run and Office Pro 365 Pro Plus as a deployment. We'll go across device. We'll talk about how it impacts your end users. But devices is critical from an Office 365 perspective, and we want to have the core investments always being made around the user experience and how they are actually interfacing with Office, whether it's on an iPhone, a Windows phone, an iPad, or an Android, or on a Surface, or on a desktop that might be still the prevalent way of interfacing with Office. Moving from a cloud perspective, and we're talking about a lot about this today, but the investment from a cloud perspective, not only to have services that sit in Microsoft data centers, help you be secure and backed up and deliver those great experiences across devices, but also as part of the new cloud deployment model, being able to deploy services quickly and easily, have roaming profiles that work with Office across your devices, all of your MRU, your recently used, and being able to edit and have Office web apps, that all comes from a service perspective. So the cloud is obviously a huge investment from the Microsoft perspective around the new Office. From a social, it's not just about going somewhere to be social, logging into a web page, being social with friends or family or coworkers, but it's about having that social experience throughout all of Office. So whether you're working on a document with your team and want to have the back and forth communication to really nail down the document and be able to work through, or if it's having that multi-video, multi-party chat, being able to communicate no matter where people are, that's a huge social capability that comes from the link perspective. So not just a place to go and be social or a one-off type of product, but having social aspects across all Office applications and all Office experiences. And then obviously control, and we'll talk a little bit about this today, and Alistair will touch on it from a data center and from the infrastructure perspective, making sure that IT pros feel in control, have the controls available to them to truly administer a service, and also continually to adding to that control with features like DLP, e-discovery, and stepping up our services to be world-class from a control perspective. So these are the Office 365 core investments from the Office team where we want to shine across the board. And we're going to get into a little bit of the details of those. But what I wanted to really talk about is the difference between enterprise grade, and comprehensive tools in what you might experience as a consumer with cloud services. Office 365 is built cloud enterprise grade. And we want to have those best experiences, those core investments we're making across devices, no matter what device you're using. So the tools you need to get your job done, to be in control, to help your end users, but also delivered as that enterprise-grade service with financially backed SLAs, with true enterprise standards and control and conduct from a data center perspective, worldwide data centers that allow for that global connectivity, and really bringing across all of the cloud services so the experience from the end user is seamless. And underneath there, you see from a dynamic workplace, making sense of it all, these are kind of the taglines of how we market and where we talk to our customers about Office 365. But what I wanted to kind of position is, hey, no matter what we're doing from a breadth of Microsoft, with natural expression, with gesture control, with immersive experiences, all of those are core to the enterprise-grade quality that we deliver. So it really is about being enterprise-ready, being enterprise-grade. As a customer, you are a Microsoft customer. You are not the product. And we see that a lot with free services, that as a customer, when something is free, every so now and then, you're probably the product that they're selling to their competitors or to their databases or to someone else that actually makes you the product as a consumer. In an enterprise-grade service, it's not free, but you are the customer. And we build this for you, for the IT pro, to truly deliver on the value side. So getting into that, I'm going to switch it over to Alistair and let Alistair talk about some of that enterprise-grade control. And from a deployment perspective, these are the things we deploy so that you can then deploy the services quickly and easily on your side. So go
Thanks,
for it,
Jeff.
Alistair.
So when I moved from Australia to Seattle about 3 years ago to join the Office 365 team, I kind of thought at the time, you know, how hard can this be? Hosting, people have done it for a long time with Exchange, with SharePoint, OCS, LCS before that. So how hard can it be? And how different can it be? But what I've seen is that in Office 365, it's such, even though it's the same software, it's such a different approach to deploying, to scaling out, and to managing this infrastructure that it almost beggars belief. I mean, if you were trying to deploy Exchange or SharePoint today, you'd start with something like this. Maybe you have a server room. In Office 365, our server rooms are a little bit different as well. I mean, this looks fairly traditional, but there's a couple of things that you'll start to notice here. You know, you see each room in this data center is actually hermetically sealed off. So you can see that access control at the end there. You can see each rack is locked. You can see those little tags on the racks as well. You know, that's just to indicate that this is a high business impact data. So this particular server room here is running customer data, it's running customer email, as opposed to some other section, could be Bing, could be Xbox Live, could be something else that isn't as critical, has different people with different access controls to it, different locks on the racks, and different controls hooked up along this as well. You can see up the top something that you may not be as familiar with if you're not accustomed to massive data centers like this. You see all that yellow piping is actually holding optical fiber cable. So every rack is actually an optical fiber backbone there. That just gives you an idea of the amount of bandwidth that's going through this infrastructure just in this one server room here as well. And when we look at kind of the scale that we get from our data centers, you know, when we look at a data center, we don't consider it a data center unless it has more than 60,000 or so servers. Anything smaller than that, facility, server room, couple of servers under your desk or something like that. But 60,000 is kind of the old benchmark now. And we're starting more and more now to just measure it in megawatts. You know, we don't really care how many servers are in there or out. We just care about how much power is it consuming and how much IT compute is coming out of that particular center. And whether that's a bunch of servers or it's a bunch of high-powered servers or even more low-powered servers, it doesn't really matter. It's just a mix and match of how much bang for our buck can we get with that amount of megawatts in that particular hardware. But one thing that you can see when you're running so many servers, you need very extensive cabling standards. And this is probably one of the things that amazed me most about the Office 365 data centers is that I was probably more of an artist when it came to cabling, let's say that. But when you have so many servers, you have so much infrastructure, it's very important that you standardize in a very clear fashion, you know, the color of the cables, the tags you put in, anything like that as well. But servers are only half the problem when you're looking at a really scalable service. The problem with servers is they generate a lot of heat. So you need to start scaling out your air processing units and those sorts of things for a massive scale as well. This is an example of some of our cooling systems as well. You can see they're built into containers as well. We kind of just drop them in into these data centers, and away they go, hooked up to the infrastructure there as well. So a lot of our engineers on site at the data center are actually more, you know, hardware engineers, more mechanical engineers, electrical engineers, because they don't really care about the software or the IT stuff. We can do that remotely. You know, the things that do take a lot of their time are things like this, managing the airflow through those data centers, making sure that the climate is optimal for all that compute to run. Of course, with all that cooling and all that servers, you need to consume a lot of electricity. So failover after failover, your electrical load as well is something that's incredibly important. So you can see a big investment here in terms of the generators and the power units that we have running here as well. So this is an example of kind of one of our data centers. It's sort of traditional. It's evolved a little bit more. We still consider this sort of a co-located data center where everything's still operating on racks. It's been very efficiently optimized to run at those racks at a larger scale. But the challenge with that is you still have to build a building, and you still have to build out all this infrastructure just to run servers. And most of us have kind of grown up in a way that we try to run servers in a building that was built for people. You know, it has air conditioning, it's at the temperatures that we like, it has the airflow that we like, it has the weight limits in the floors that average people will need. 50 years later, as we're running more and more of this infrastructure, the buildings that we have aren't really built for it. So we have to start building data centers, building buildings specifically designed for this sort of compute load. And we take that one step forward. We self-contain everything itself, so we don't even need to build the data center. We can just plug all the units, all the most critical parts of the data center together, and that can form our own data center. So what you can see here is the IT load unit. That's about 4,000 servers in that particular container. If you saw the keynote, Scott Guthrie showed some of the older style containers, the ISO shipping containers we use. You know, they were great for portability and scalability. Don't really have the right thermal properties, though, when you're running a lot of servers inside them. So we started to prefab these units ourselves, a very particular size here. And you can see what's happening on the top is we're bolting in an air handling unit. So as the air gets sucked through those servers from each side, that air handling unit at the top is going to pull out that hot air and recycle it through there. And you can see those vents. And it's just that airflow motion and those vents that control the temperature going into that data center unit to keep the temperature a very consistent temperature inside. So we used to build these things kind of in a shed, you know, put a roof over it to keep the most of the worst of the weather out. But we don't even do that anymore. We essentially build them outside, exposed to the elements. You can see here the units all plugged together. This is perhaps a better shot here. You can see how the air handling units, the cooling units, the IT server load all just plugs together, and you have this kind of Lego-looking data center. And that's really the scale that we need to be able to provision a really highly available service. And there are really only three organizations in the world that can do this sort of thing. There's three organizations that buy about 40% of all servers sold worldwide. Microsoft's one of them. And that's kind of the economy of scale that you get with these sorts of systems. As you're running more and more servers, it's the things that allow us to deliver a 50-gig mailbox, 25-gig SkyDrive site, you know, 4.9s availability, and those sorts of things. We need kind of this sort of scale to be able to do it as well. That's just the hardware. Then when you look at the architecture inside of Office 365, it starts to look very different from what you're probably used to in on-premises deployment as well. You can see here, this is an example of Exchange Online. We essentially partition the network into a lot of smaller nodes, and each kind of stamp or each partition is about 150,000 users at a time, give or take. And that's kind of our unit of scalability. We don't look at adding another terabyte for these users or another server here or there. We look at how do we scale out 150,000 users at a time, because that's about the scale that our poor human minds can deal with when we're scaling out these sort of infrastructure. So when we get to that cap, we'll put in another 150,000 user infrastructure and those sorts of things as well. So for those of you familiar with Exchange, Exchange Online is just Exchange behind the scenes. It may be massive Exchange, maybe running in very foreign-looking buildings, but it is actually still Exchange. So everything inside of it, you know, you have your CAS array, you have your database access groups, you know, you group them into what the engineers lovingly call the DAG array, and then you run thousands of DAGs across all this infrastructure as well. It's a very DAG-y environment. But to do that, You have patches as well. And so there's patches every single week, every single month. I'm sure you're all dealing with patches, Patch Tuesday, hot fixes you need to apply and those sorts of things. And a funny thing happens when you're running across 30 or 40,000 different servers and you're trying to patch 30 or 40,000 different servers. You get what we call configuration drift. Sooner or later, there's something that happens on one particular server that's just a little bit different to the other server, and a little bit different to the server next to it. And all of a sudden, the next time a patch rolls around or next time a change happens, you get kind of this emergent complexity in this environment. So the way that we handle this, and it's kind of a funny way, that instead of patching, we just wipe the server and start again. So essentially, every server here just lives for about 2 weeks. We install it, it runs, joins an array, starts accepting traffic, then we decommission it, start to take the traffic off it onto the other servers, shut that server down, format, reinstall, bring it back, make sure it's healthy, and rejoin the network as well. All of these changes are essentially done through code in that respect. It's imaged, it's flattened, and it's put back on. So there's an incredible amount of data center automation to bring that up and down. Even with that amount of automation, we're still at any given timing running perhaps 5 or 6 different versions of Exchange inside of the data center at any given time. And if you're on Office 365, you don't actually notice these transitions behind the scenes. It's totally seamless to the user. And we make sure that we spread those mailboxes across multiple stamps and multiple partitions here. So in the case of one going down, either if that's on purpose to bring it up to the latest baseline, or if it happens from some accident or something like that, you still have your mail being serviced out of a number of different physical infrastructures in that environment as well. Taking a look at SharePoint, and for those, who's a SharePoint admin in the room? A couple of people? Okay, well, SharePoint has a very different architecture to Exchange. But SharePoint Online is still just SharePoint, so it's a very similar infrastructure inside it. You start with AD, your directory, you bolt on your SQL servers, then you have your content farms, your web front ends, your CA service, your crawlers, your sandboxes, your timer jobs, your federated services, things that you need to connect up with other SharePoint farms. And we kind of group all that together, again, into one of these stamps between 150 and 200,000 users at a time. And it's these stamps that are then rolled out. You know, the nice thing in SharePoint is that we use Hyper-V for all of these servers as well. So the SharePoint Online farm is all Hyper-V. Everything running it, apart from the host servers, is actually a virtual machine. It gives us much faster turnaround to do that. And we can just stamp out those stamps to expand inside of the data center itself. Inside of that data center, then we group multiple of these networks together, use network load balancing on the front of it, and then make sure it's also running in 2 separate data centers here at any given time. So this is how we get our high availability, our resiliency, our redundancy through this massive infrastructure here. It's about 30,000 virtual machines running here, about 8,000 physical machines. Is it servicing up our SharePoint Online numbers? And of course, that number keeps growing, so by the time I get back and look at the dashboard again, it'll most probably be different as we expand and expand, add more and more service capacity here as well. There are a couple of things, and you know, this is just default SharePoint, default Windows Server, default Active Directory. It's highly configured, it's highly scripted. The thing that starts to make SharePoint Online unique is what we call the Grid Manager, which is just essentially all that scripting, all that PowerShell to run that entire environment, to scale out and to know when to roll things out, to collect all the logs from these environments. This environment here will generate about 24 terabytes of logging files a day. There are a lot of logs that we look at for reactive help, is when we know a particular node in the server, a particular stamp is down. There are a lot of logs that we look at immediately. But in that 24 terabytes of logging, there's also interesting kind of data that may not be as critical today to fix, but it's something we need to look at as well. And so some of that stuff is actually compiled overnight. We compile that 24 terabytes of logging into something that someone actually can read and action and start to look at trends and start to look at how that environment's functioning, whether there's particular hardware, particular virtual machines on particular hardware that's running faster or slower than others, whether we need to add more capacity, whether there's bottlenecks or throttles, whether there's more exceptions that we see in certain areas that we don't expect in other networks. All that sort of thing is what our engineering analysts do to make sure this environment is running as healthy as possible. So it's a pretty complicated environment. And perhaps another way to look at that is what happens when you save a document into SharePoint. And when you save a document into SharePoint, essentially you're doing a save to a disk, and you're making a copy of that particular document. And this is the same if it's SharePoint on-prem or SharePoint online. But of course, you'll generally run something like RAID 10 across that disk. You don't want just one disk to fail to lose that document. That would be a bad thing. So you're generally running RAID 10. You have two copies of that particular file in the system at any given time. And maybe you'll run synchronous mirroring across that SQL cluster to move it across to a separate rack, separate infrastructure, just in case someone trips over the cable where they're vacuuming the server room or something like that. It doesn't happen in our data center, but it may in yours. I've heard all sorts of stories about things going wrong with server rooms, you know, being unplugged at night to save power, turned off on the weekend. We'll just shut half the servers off because half of the staff are away. all sorts of things like that the managers do. But essentially now we'll then use asynchronous log shipping to ship that content across to a separate data center as well. So we have, you know, six or so copies of a particular file every time you hit save into SharePoint in this particular case at this stage. That's just with SQL, with log shipping, and with the way that we RAID these servers together. Of course, then we take scheduled backups of that. We asynchronously replicate those scheduled backups across. This enables us to do point-in-time restores. So if something does happen, if there's a corruption that's introduced in either the RAID process or the SQL clustering, we can actually go back to that point-in-time restore and restore that stamp itself through that approach there as well. So that's creating over 10 copies of that one document at this stage. And of course, there's a recycle bin there that the admins that you can restore your users from. There's a user recycle bin that they can restore their document from. There's also a client-side cache as well. So in that cache is on the client side, so if there's any connectivity problems between when that user hits save and it hitting the SharePoint server itself, there's a copy of that document that can repair that environment as well. So this is sort of the complexity of saving in SharePoint. Some of you that are running SharePoint today, you may have it across RAID 10, you may be doing scheduled backups and those sorts of things. This sort of infrastructure, when we're looking at delivering 25 gigs of storage for every single user in Office 365, and then we're keeping 10 copies of that 25 gigs of data throughout the system as well, is quite a staggering amount of content as well. So lastly, when we have that amount of hardware, that amount of architecture running, system monitoring becomes very important as well. I mentioned logging. We do a lot of logging in the service to measure all of that as well. But logging's kind of the inside view of what's going on in the service as well. And logging, once upon a time, and this is a little bit of a dirty secret, but if anyone's familiar with System Center Operations Manager, we had the Exchange Management Pack for Exchange as an example. It had 1,700 different actions that could be triggered, that could be logged, and could be looked at as well. That's a lot of different logs that you could catch, a lot of actions that you could act on and those sorts of things. Turns out only 200 of those 1,700 actually indicated some sort of user-facing issue. So even though we'd throw 1,700 different logs, and the mentality for the engineer was, well, I'm going to throw an action here, so when I'm debugging this particular line of code, I know exactly where that's happening as well. Whereas in a service, you're not really interested in looking at every single issue that's happening, only the issues that are affecting your users as well. You have this mean time to recovery is a more important metric than mean time to failure as well. So while logging's great, we also augment that with a lot of outside-in logging as well. So what this is we're running around the world about 200 to 250 different locations around the world, and we're constantly pinging every layer of Office 365, the Exchange servers, the SharePoint servers, the identity servers, and those sorts of things. And this is really simulating user load from all of these points around the world. This is how we know that New Zealand customers are suffering, there's an issue between Singapore, the Singapore data center might be healthy, but something's going wrong in that connection between New Zealand and Singapore. Or there's something happening at the other side of the world, or there's an issue happening in Exchange, but the logging's not quite picking it up, or something like that. So this is really important, and this is how we generate so much log files, but it's actually how we can run the service at the reliability level we do. So that's kind of a quick view into what deployment looks like from Office 365 side, from our side. But the good news is, you know, for your side to use Office 365, deployment's a lot simpler than that. You don't have to go through all of those steps to do that. We've done a lot of that heavy lifting for you. So Jeff's going to talk you through what you can do to benefit.
Yeah, thank you, Alistair. So every time you sign up for Office 365 or create a new mailbox, all that happens in the background. And I think it's critical that we show that and try to explain what the data center and what the actual operations looks like, because that is what every single mailbox and every single SharePoint site and every single link user gets when you implement Office 365. So, you know, our challenge and our challenge with you and our customers is then to make it as easy as possible to move to Office 365. Maybe it's just a single workload. Maybe it's your entire infrastructure from a SharePoint and Exchange and Link perspective. But we want to help, and it's really our team's job to help IT pros and end users move to Office 365 successfully. And our methodology for that is called Fast Track. And we've been working for the last 5 or 6 years through many iterations of deployment, 100-page guides, 2-page guides, 10-page that links you to 1,000 different places type of guides. So we have been iterating on this for many years with our customers and partners' feedback. And really, we're trying to get to a point where we can help guide our customers through deployment, also starting from a pilot perspective, and move through at your pace, at your will, to the products and services that you want to move to. And what you see from a fast track perspective with Office 365 deployment is that, one, make it easy to pilot. So if you haven't tried Office 365 yet, we want to help guide you through a pilot. And from a pilot perspective, we want you to actually start using some cloud services. You don't have to do a big infrastructure change to sign up for Office 365 and start using SkyDrive, or to even use connected accounts. And we're going to get into a little bit of this as we go. Step two is when you really start to move to a deployment. So giving you some options and tools to help remediate your Active Directory, help get you connected from a mailbox perspective, and then even some of the shared namespace and routing so that you can start using the service in a smaller patch of your users. And then step three is where some of the more detailed, complex scenarios can come into play. If Active Directory Federation services or hybrid configurations is something that your business absolutely requires, you can move through these steps fairly quickly and easily and get to those more complex scenarios as your users are fully adopted on the solution. So when we look at these in detail from a pilot, deploy, and enhance, really it is you can start in hours, start deploying in days, and then move through the next scenarios as your business adjusts in time. And from a pilot perspective, it's the full Office 365 service. It's being able to utilize connected accounts, connected mailboxes, being able to actually log into SharePoint using the .onmicrosoft.com domain. It's kind of a chicken and the egg thing. We want you to have a domain so that you can start the service and so that it's fully functioning. And then later you can add your domain, your .com, so that you can then have that seamless namespace. But you can always start with the .onmicrosoft.com, and that is a cloud identity that we'll talk about. And as you move through some of the scenarios, which are fairly user-driven, Office client install, self-service, SkyDrive Pro, connected accounts where you can actually draw in your mail from POP3 and IMAP and still have that as part of the service, we want you to experience that. And what we've seen is that some of our customers say, Office 365 looks like something for my business. We want to be able to utilize this. And then in starts a 12-week project engagement to get you to your first mailbox. And we really think that utilizing the service in a pilot, having a very kind of guided walkthrough, helps with you can actually experience these things. You can experience the new office before you start doing a really deep, in-depth deployment. But as you move to step two, it just builds upon what's possible. You start to get the shared namespace where you can verify your name record. You can do that really quick and easy with a CNAME. And then you can start utilizing the service with directory sync. And I'm going to actually walk through that in a little bit. So that all your user administration happens in your AD, pushes that information up to the cloud, and makes it easier from an identity perspective. And you can layer on what we'll talk about in a minute, which is password sync. So we've talked about passwords, AD, ADFS. There is a step-by-step process that you can start your directory sync, push your users into the cloud service without having to manage them in two places, and enable password sync, which takes no extra infrastructure on your side, and it doesn't transfer the password's clear text to the cloud. It literally hashes the hash and then moves them to the service, so that from an end user perspective, I use my corporate login with my corporate credentials, and I'm now logging into the cloud. ADFS takes that another step further, and we'll go into some of those details. And step three brings in some of the federation and hybrid delegation. ADFS, as I talked about, where you actually are controlling the passwords and you become that single point of authentication as an organization, and the cloud simply is going to reference your Active Directory for that login. So these are the steps that we want to kind of walk through now and talk about as we move through this. And some of the benefits of that, and I've kind of weaved these in, but you can pilot without throwing it away. You can deploy quickly and easily with a more richer experience for a group of your end users. Time to value versus the time invested, we hope we'll see that kind of skyrocketing within your organization. You can start this at any time, and then you have all these identity options, whether it's cloud, DirSync, or then step three, moving into that full control from an ADFS perspective. And it starts with guidance. And fasttrack.office.com is our deployment guidance. And what you'll see there is basically step one, step two, step three. If you're already a customer and you just haven't yet deployed everything out, you can start on step two, and you'll see line-by-line instructions on how to actually go through that. And this will be available, and I'm actually going to demo it a little bit. But this is our, from a Microsoft perspective, it starts with how do we help from a public guidance and then move into some of those deeper scenarios. So fasttrack.office.com is step-by-step, links you to the tools and resources you need, and should help you at least see how we intend our customers to walk through these deployment scenarios. So what does the pilot experience look like? Well, it's pretty well scripted. You have a cloud identity sign-on. You have the ability to use mail with an Exchange mailbox and OA. You can also connect Office to that mailbox. If you want to have a connected account, you can utilize POP3 and IMAP back to your Exchange server to actually draw in mail into OA. And that means you're not losing mail or losing the experience. So if you have a set of kind of business stakeholders within your org, challenging and talking about moving to the cloud, and from an IT perspective, you want to deliver some of these services quickly, you can open up POP and IMAP, have them log into Outlook Web Access, and you'll actually be able to put some of their mail there so they can directly see what it looks like in a brand new experience. And in this same piloting scenario, go to the iOS App Store, download Office, go download SkyDrive Pro, do it across your devices, and you have a very rich experience still utilizing a cloud identity. In this pilot, you can start immediately through a normal E3 trial. It actually is kind of step one in the fasttrack.office.com. But this is the experience we expect within this kind of confines of this box. So if you are become familiar with this, able to position it to your business side or to some of your end users, you can be sure that if we're moving through step one, two, and three, this is the experience you can give during this phase of the deployment.
And too often when we've seen on-premises deployments, you often start with the pilot, you try and you run a smaller environment, maybe you have one server or a virtual machine, and you have 10 people running on that. And when you do get the go-ahead for a wider production rollout, then it's almost like you have to just start again. You need to re-architect everything. You didn't build the pilot to be a pilot. Maybe you downloaded some VMs or something like that to set it all up. And maybe as some of your users got so hooked on the pilot, they actually put a lot of their production information there. You know, they've been using it for their business. And then all of a sudden you get this nasty kind of trade-off between, well, I need to upgrade to production, but I need to take all the work they already did in the pilot environment. And it just doesn't quite come across as well, and you start to make trade-offs in the architecture that you choose for that production environment. So the great thing about this Office 365 is it's that seamless transition from pilot to production.
Yep, being able to add and grow from basically where you start from. And there's just a couple key points from a technical side to think about as you move through pilot, and we're trying to graph that out to show you that, yeah, you're going to start with a cloud ID. Do you want your users to do a more self-service migration of connected accounts, enable them to do POP and IMAP directly from your exchange? Or do you want to do a little bit more of IT-driven? Maybe it's getting PSTs, their old PSTs, into the cloud, starting them with some of their information that they would, that they might see as archive, being able to push that up into a cloud mailbox. 50 gigs for every single mailbox from Office 365, plus archiving, which is either personal archive or paid for archive. I mean, you have the ability to do PST import from an IT-driven mode to really help get customer, your end customer, end user data into Office 365. So some of the choices that you might make during pilot from an IT side is, okay, we're going to start with cloud identities. What's that going to look like? How do I want to, you know, image that out to my users? We want them to start with Outlook web access. Maybe we have device proliferation from an iPad or Android, iOS, or maybe we're looking at doing a POC with some tablets, surfaces, maybe putting some of this information on those. So it's really some of the decision points during pilot that can help you pick your stakeholders, pick who you want to move to the service first, and then start moving through. And then what starts to get added from the deploy side is that you utilize DirSync to get more of an integrated approach. And with DirSync, that's directory synchronization, you basically run an appliance off of your DC. It takes a snapshot of your DC, pushes that up into the cloud, and your users are built for you. And you can then start to do a shared namespace so that yourcompany.com is what they log in with. They can have the email coming directly to their .com address. They can log into everything, share SharePoint files, SkyDrive Pro, and it all starts to become more of that seamless experience. And that's where the deploy phase really, from a scope perspective, where we want to walk our customers through. Managed mobile connectivity, being able to look at Office 365 Pro Plus, the rich client click to run, as a IT deploy perspective. We're going to get into that tomorrow in the click to run session on how do you deploy that as an IT pro out to your end users, even though it's utilizing the cloud. And it really walks through and hopefully feels like a step-by-step, make some decisions and move through the deployment quick and easy. And what that looks like from a deploy using cloud identity is you start that shared namespace. You then have that choice again. Are we going to do an IT or partner-led type of deployment migration? Are we going to use PST? Maybe we're going to do some import tool or IMAP migrations. How do we get these mailboxes totally moved up to the service? So making sure that with it, the end user side, are the IT decisions of how you would like to deploy. And this is also where, from a Microsoft perspective, we are funding our partners and our services is in this step too. So if you're, this was announced, I guess, back in July, and it started on September 1st. If you're 150 seats and above purchasing Office 365 between September 1st and then March 30th, you actually get dollars towards partners. And your partners will be scoped on step two to do these for those dollars. So Microsoft is heavily investing in step two deployments with our partners and customers. So whether you're using Microsoft services or utilizing a partner, a cloud deployment partner, they will actually be able to walk through this scope of work and have it funded from a Microsoft perspective to the best of Microsoft's ability. So it goes in a step-by-step. And you can see that on fasttrack.office.com/offer, and you'll see those details. So we talked about some of the directory synchronization options, and I wanted to go just a little bit deeper, and we have a few more minutes to talk before a little bit of a demo. DirSync, Office 365 connectors, PowerShell and Graph API. If you go online right now and search for Office 365 identity, these are all the things you're going to find. And yes, you'll probably be confused. It's our fault. It's okay. We have a lot of different options for identity. What I want you to really focus in on is the DirSync side, because DirSync with Password Sync is really a very easy way of implementing directory synchronization and having a not a true single sign-on, but a single sign-on experience for all of your end users. So we're going to focus a little bit on this left-hand side as we talk about, but I wanted to show you, yes, there are deep options. There are works with options with different connectors and identity solutions. And you'll see those in the marketplace. You'll see them on our documentation. But really, from a core onboarding experience, DirSync with Password Sync is truly a great step forward. And if you want to move into some of these deeper integrations with ADFS, you can always do that on top. You're not on a dead-end road. So what does it look like from a cloud identity? It's a CVS import or CSV import. It's being able to, you could still do DirSync if you wanted to, but they will soft match on top of that .on Microsoft.com address. Basically, a CSV import or add the users yourself. You're going to manage that identity as a separate identity from your environment. And all of the admin portal, activation services, everything that happens in Office 365 will be based on the information that you put into the cloud identity. So a CSV or you manually building out some users, this is definitely easy to do during a pilot. You could pick 7, 10, 25 users, do the CSV import, and they immediately will have their credentials available to them. As you move towards password sync with directory sync, you have an Active Directory on your premises. You then connect it up through DirSync to our cloud environment. In the cloud environment, which is Windows Azure Active Directory, you have all the federation, graph API, metadata, everything that happens within that Azure AD. And then it authenticates to Office 365 for all those services. So you don't have to build the users online. It comes from your Active Directory. But again, with a you have to enable password sync to really give that true end user experience to move through. Taking it that one step further for the federated identity, you see a DirSync server, Active Directory Federation Services. There's a one-way trust. There's one box there on the left. But in reality, if you want to have a true high availability solution, it's a minimum 8 servers across 2 locations. So if you'd like to control your identity, absolutely. But you are then becoming the single point of failure for your cloud because you become the master of all of the identities. The service will literally never answer a login request. It will always push down to your Active Directory. Your Active Directory will supply the certificates and the things necessary, push up into the cloud and allow that user access. So high availability, being able to have connectivity maybe through VPN or through proxies, reverse proxies into your Active Directory. For a lot of our enterprise customers, this is critical and they want to do this. But for a lot of our customers who simply have one site or don't have multiple data centers they're already running from, don't have a huge IT investment from a server infrastructure, this becomes kind of a barrier to entry. And that's why we developed Password Sync, is to really try to help our customers utilize some of the benefits of this, which is the single sign-on experience, with the ability to do it quickly and easily.
It's actually something that we've seen a lot of organizations mistake in their business continuity planning. They think, we've moved to Office 365, continuity of operations is Microsoft's problem now, and in event of natural disasters, something like that, our data center will stay up, but just the fact that they've chosen to go down an ADFS path and not architected that in a high availability state does mean that the end user experience will be down if that ADFS environment is down. And if that's down, then really the only way to go forward is to build that back up before it'll work again. So it's a very complex process when something like that happens. We had a large American bank, it had its great headquarters, in lower Manhattan, just by one of the rivers. And of course, when one of the hurricanes came through a couple of years ago, their data center, or what they considered a data center, was in the basement. And the basement flooded up until B3. The power went out. They couldn't even get down to the servers. Email was down. And there is essentially nothing you can do at that point until you drain out the basement. And so that's a very challenging place. And I think now that we have DirSync and Password Sync, we get that same end user experience. We don't get as rich a single sign-on experience in terms of SAML tokens and controlling that, but we do get a single username, a single password, login, and still controlling everything from AD. And if AD goes down, you'll still be able to log into Office 365.
Yeah, that's a perfect example, because the call comes to Microsoft and says, your Exchange is down. And then we route all the way back to say, yeah, your Active Directory is actually failed out. We're unable to authenticate your users. Exchange Online is still at 100%. So it's a great example, and it's too bad that we have to use examples of those things, but that is really the way that in reality, if customers are taking an ADFS approach, beautiful, just make sure it's being data center located and on upper floors that don't have weight restrictions on the ground. So we're going to go through a little bit of a demo from a DirSync perspective, because I wanted to show from an ease of use perspective as the IT. I have a system running that's off of my DC, and it's my DirSync appliance. And so on my desktop, I have the DirSync configuration and also this tool called IDFix. And this is all lined out in the Fast Track site with the different steps and tools that can be used. One of the things we've seen from our customers' perspective is AD remediation is something that is necessary. You guys have been running your AD for many years, however you'd like, maybe not quite per the Microsoft guidelines, but we want to make sure that it's easy for your AD to integrate with our cloud. We do have a little bit more stringent pieces from an AD perspective in Windows Azure AD. So one of the things we built as an onboarding tool is IDFix. IDFix will actually open up and go directly against your Active Directory. You can see I'm just gonna simply hit the query, and it's gonna pull in all of the attributes that Microsoft will not accept into Windows Azure AD. You can't imagine before this tool how hard this probably was, because you would simply directory sync, it would fail, and as Alistair mentioned, 25 terabytes of logs. We would have to then find the logs on why these AD objects failed and then continue with some troubleshooting. So you can run IDFix now against your Active Directory, see what is actually there. And so I see that from a character perspective, I have some bad characters in Alan Brewer. And I can simply select the action to edit, and it's going to update it as it states from an update perspective, and it's going to allow me to move through, have these updates made. But always, as any time, you might make an update, and then that person calls and says, hey, can't log into anything, or can't get my mail, or can't do A, B, or C, and you might need to roll it back and then try to reconfigure it another way. So we also allow that as you go through the actions and save and say to edit or remove, or it's a duplicate, that every single time you do a save or do an action, it will post the backup directly to the folder you run it from, and you can always open that backup and revert directly back to how you had it before the end user had their problem. So this is just a quick and easy tool, but we've seen from AD remediation in our large organizations go from maybe 4 weeks to really resolve some AD issues down to a week and a half. So with smaller organizations, very quick. And we're seeing these changes happen rapidly as we put these tools out. So as I go through and make my AD changes, edit, go through, and then I'm good to go on a DirSync perspective. So I've made those changes on the Active Directory. It comes away with no issues. And then the directory sync configuration tool directly download from Microsoft. It runs off of your domain controller. And I wish it was more technical, but it's a wizard. You're now going to reach into your AD, start the DirSync process. It's then going to run as a service, and it's going to keep your AD changes information up to date with Office 365. So I'm going to log in with my Office 365 creds. And I can't type and talk. So
a couple of things while he types. That IDFix tool, it's never too soon to run that tool. I mean, it's a lot of the things that you find in Active Directories these days have been hanging around from previous upgrades or maybe migration from the identity platform you had before you put in AD, something like that. So these tools are just a great way to just kind of clean up that. Even if you're not planning to go to Office 365, if you're planning on upgrading the schema later on or those sorts of things, it's just now's a great time to get rid of some of those old bad characters and like at locals and all that sort of stuff that's still hanging around.
Yep. And as I went through, I simply gave it my online creds, my admin creds to the AD. It's asking me if I want to enable hybrid deployment. So if I was going to be in a hybrid mode, I can enable that here so that the Active Directory in Azure can actually write back to my AD the necessary information to run hybrid. And it's a tick box. Moving through, I talked up password sync and how awesome it is. It's a tick box. So if you remember old PCNS and things that could run to update, that's no longer. This is all utilizing directory sync. It's built into the tool. It's built into the motion. If you want your end users' passwords on premises to add to the cloud, it's a tick box. And your directory synchronization will happen every so often for changes. That password piece will happen anytime there's a change made. So it is always going, and it is always going to make those updates. And it's now making the tick, configuring, and it's moving up to the cloud. So from a cloud perspective, I'm logged into my admin portal. And from an admin perspective, this is where I administer all Office 365 services. And it's going a little bit slower on the internet side here. But you see I have these active users. And all I had to do in the online world is activate directory sync. So click a button, run dir sync, hit passwords, and you'll start to see users fill into this environment. So from a user perspective, being able to use your AD, that's a simple part of the deployment process. I couldn't make it any simpler than that wizard. Obviously, we saw that AD remediation is critical, or you'll have errors. But as you move through, I now have users being built into the Office 365 service directly from my AD, and I can license and choose who I'm going to use from then on. From a domain perspective, I can then move directly into the domains, add my domain as a verified domain, input my CNAME record into DNS, whether it's my own provider or my own servers, and add my domain, customer.com, so that you can start having that shared namespace. So these are just a couple steps that I wanted to really highlight that we've built tools around, where we're really looking forward from an onboarding perspective to help our customers move through. And that is the kind of identity piece that we really wanted to talk about, because there's a lot of questions on identity. We do a ton of sessions on it. So hopefully that helped from the deployment perspective to see it. Running off a DC, connecting in, moving those users over. And then from an admin side, you literally can start from the users and groups. All of your security groups, all of your DLs, everything comes from dir sync. So you don't have to build any of that within the service. And then all of your users and groups, you can simply move through license and then have them as part of that deployment. So as I look at Karen Berg or someone who's coming through, they will come through from DirSync unlicensed, and then I can simply license them. And this is the UI I'm working through, but you can do all of this via PowerShell. So if you love opening the command prompt, doing PowerShell, you simply are licensing your users, and they are then becoming users of Office 365. The next piece would then be moving their mailboxes through, utilizing staged, full cutover migration with the tools that Microsoft provides, or working with a partner or a third party on tools that they provide. So getting a little bit back to you can see that I actually completed. It's now synchronizing all the directories. Done. That's now running as a service. I don't have to think about that anymore. It literally will run and continue to run. And what we've seen is if anyone has issues with a server or it goes down or something within their environment, you just run this from another place, another time, and be able to manage right through that. So this server is now a DirSync server running in my environment, helping my users get built in the cloud. So going back to the last couple slides. So I wanted to close off on that. ID fix, fasttrack.office.com for the steps and the guidance, being able to work through directory sync, the administration portal. I know it's kind of a light demo from that perspective, but we wanted to really get through a lot of this content. And I wanted to bring Marissa up, talk about the other side of deployment, end users, and helping, Microsoft helping IT pros deliver to the end user so that, I'll let Marissa talk about it. I'm stealing her thunder.
I'll be quick because I know we're running a little bit short on time, but I'm Marissa Salazar. I work on the same team as Jeff and Alistair, and I focus all of my time on the end user and everything that goes along with that. So when it comes down to it, and everything that we're going to talk about through the whole week, we want people using our products, and we want them using them in a way that's effective for them and their business. And we really do see customers craving help in, that readiness and adoption areas at the end user level. So I'm here to say we hear that loud and clear, and we're working fast and furious on ways to continue to address the end user and help them learn and become better users of our products. So we really find when learning how to use Office products at the end user level, especially with something so complex like Office, it's better to do that learning in bite-sized increments. We want people with Office 365 to continue to learn throughout their journey of Office 365, to become better users every single day. And this is opposed to the idea of handing somebody a manual and having them read through it and say, great, you're an Office 365 power user, you're good to go. That's just not how people learn in the context of their everyday lives. So we're working on end user materials. I have with me here a picture of what this booklet I have in my hand. And what it is a use case catalog talking about how to introduce Office 365 to your end users. And what we focus on in here is contextual, simple steps to help people achieve things right off of the bat. If you start learning right when you start using Office 365, you're going to be more inclined to keep learning and discovering all of the awesome things that are in there for end users. And if you take a look at one of these booklets, you'll discover the methodology in there is, there's tasks that we all do as end users. I say that generally, but we all spend time in Outlook, and we all, create things. We all share with our colleagues. And then there's things that are specific to different types of roles and responsibilities. An HR director has different goals than somebody in research and development, and as does finance and sales and marketing, and somebody in legal might be really interested in e-discovery while somebody else might not be as interested. So I have some of these booklets with me here, and I also have some back at the office booth in the showcase. So if you want to talk about end user adoption, readiness, and the methodology that we're looking at here, come talk to me afterwards, and I can tell you a little bit more about it.
Thank you, Marissa.
Thanks.
So to close out, want to get to questions so that people can win things, because we have a stack of things to win here. So let's get there. So I guess I will put it to Alistair for the first question for one of these.
Yeah, we have this massive, giant, remote-controlled crab thing, so we'll have a hard question for that. But if anyone else has questions,
anyone
we'll give away the little prizes first.
Yeah. We'll give away the little prizes first. Go ahead. PCI DSS compliant. I'll have to look at exactly. Can I follow up with you after this?
So Office 365 itself is PCI DSS compliant, and when you sign up, we're secured. We secure your credit cards and those sorts of things you do. If your users are sending credit cards through email, storing them in SharePoint or something like that, then we generally rely on our data loss prevention classification rules that you would set up to say, that we're going to flag this, we're going to encrypt this, we're going to bounce it completely. That's right. And we even have, I believe, a credit card, one from the DLP, and I think we have New Zealand driver's license and a couple of the other templates already in Office 365. But again, it's just an XML file, so if you have the regex for the particular strings you're looking for to block, you can set that up yourself. Yeah.
Thank you. And you can grab this at the end. Any other questions?
How is the licensing part? If they want subscription, do they have
to manual? So it's a licensing question. It's per user per month. And that's generally how it licenses, no matter. a user would have their own mailbox. You can do shared mailboxes, which don't cost anything, but the user utilizing the shared mailbox has to have a license.
So the shared mailbox, each other can see,
correct.
Each other's email.
Correct. Yep.
Sorry, just on that one. Can you have multiple shared mailboxes?
Yes, you may. So you could have sales, and then five different people have views into that sales at your company, and you could have info, support, however you have those multiple shared mailboxes.
I think in the contract, there's a limit of like 10,000, but it's not a hard limit in the system. Yep. So it's, yeah, you can just add as many as you want.
Sorry, I don't want to get, but I have to
go. 1 second, because there's a bunch of people in the back. Go ahead, stand up.
Web apps, yeah.
Absolutely. Come to the click to run session tomorrow at 9 a.m.
So, yes, in the client apps, but not the web apps.
What did he ask for? Print?
Macro in web apps.
Macro in web apps. Sorry, I didn't hear you correctly. In the client apps. Yep.
Yeah. And the reason for that is that macro code has been written before the web, essentially. It predates HTML. It was written in unmanaged code. It's Win32 specific. Even 64-bit machines will have trouble with. Our new model, the cloud app model that we've built that supports multiple devices, multiple operating systems, mobile phones, web apps, and those sorts of things is our model going forward. Doesn't mean we're going to discontinue the macros from the Office apps already, but it's not a continued area of investment.
That's a good question.
Yes.
So yes, you can.
It's a support ticket.
there will be a time. There's some timing pieces that you'd want to work out. And when you deactivate that from, you have to PowerShell deactivate it. There is timing. But yes, you can.
And sometimes it can take 48 hours. Yeah. Andrew, yeah, I've seen 48 hours for that to back out, which is not the greatest if you're underwater.
And I have a bag for you for that one.
Okay, so that's all our prizes. We'll take questions at the end, but let's give our big prize. This will fascinate your kids and horrify your pets. It's a remote control. I don't know what this is. So question, how about the checkbox in DirSync to enable a hybrid deployment? What does that enable firsthand? Incorrect. Next question. Both directions.
So you get communication between your directory and the cloud.
Yeah.
Let's be more specific. We have more of these giving away at the booth as well, so if you miss out. I look for a specific thing that... Nope. This is in the DirSync tool directly there. The Active Directory DirSync tool. Not single sign-on. I'm going to keep this, actually. There you go. The ability to write back to your domain controller. Attribute thing. So congratulations, you won this thing.
Thanks, all.
Thanks, guys. Yeah.